sky's so blue. The birds are singing, I got nothing to do. Hey, hey,
hey, hey.
It's a sunny day.
Sunny day now.
My pocket's empty, my cupboard's bare. Call me illogical, I just don't care. Hey, hey,
hey, hey, hey.
It's just a sunny day.
Hey, 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 it's a sunny day.
It's just
day.
A sunny day.
Yeah. Hey. It's the KSL Greenhouse. Expert tips for flowers, trees, gardens, and soil. Our hosts are Maria Chaleos and Ton Bettis on KSL News Radio.
Good morning. Thank you for joining us for the KSL Greenhouse. Phone lines are open this morning at 801-575-8255. You can also text us your questions at 57500. We wanted to focus on the 10 o'clock hour on growing your own salad greens, at least for the top of the hour feature here. It's something that I have not been entirely successful with, Ton, because I'm not very good at reseeding. And as I mentioned earlier, they don't regrow. You can't just cut them and think
not
that they're going to
really.
Regrow.
I mean, they will regrow a little bit.
Well,
but
they're kind of gangly. You might get a couple of
leaves. When I was up in Cache County volunteering in their jail, helping with gardening in their horticulture program, we grew lettuce in the greenhouse in pots, and we would cut it so that we left 3 or 4 inches of stem, like the leaves, mm-hmm. behind. And when we left it that high, it would regrow, but we'd only get about a third of what we did before, and just found that reseeding it was easier.
Yeah, it's not very effective.
No, but someone called earlier about what salad greens could be grown indoors, and it's literally any of them. It's just that you need to reseed and realize that even if you're doing it hydroponically, you know, a little 2x2 area where you're growing them, it'll get you a salad every couple of weeks, you know, and then you need to do it again. And so it's more for the fun and not for the vegetable productivity.
Right. If you are going to plant greens, you have to plant a lot of them and you have to reseed periodically.
You do. And so I knew a gardener up in the Cache Valley that grew lettuce for on and off, you know, from February through early June, and then again from late September through late November. She would grow her own lettuce, and on the south side of her house, she had three little pop-up cold frames that would collapse down and she could store, but then she would peg them down with stakes and put some bricks around them and things to hold them in place. But she would use the three cold frames to where she would seed one week, wait a week, do the next one, wait another week, and do the next one. So that she usually had one in production, one growing, and one reseeded, and she would just keep rotating. And then what she would do, depending on the season, as it started to get warmer, she would have varieties of lettuce that were less likely to bolt with warmer weather and less likely to get bitter. And so she would grow her own lettuce, but even then, with a little 2x3 pop-up cold frame, you know, mini greenhouse, she grew a salad a week or two salads a week with it. But it was fun. It was something she grew herself. It was pesticide-free. And every season, she would rotate on the south side of her house where they went so that she could rotate the soil a little bit. But it was a fun process. And she could grow lettuce, even in up in Cache Valley, she would start lettuce in mid-February, and she would take the time to insulate on the cold days the little cold frames with blankets and things, but she would start that lettuce in mid-February and keep it going till June.
Just depends on how much time you have to devote to this, right?
She was retired and spent a lot of her time volunteering with 3 or 4 community organizations, so she had the time. But it was just something fun to do as a gardener.
There is one great thing about planting your own lettuces is there are so many different varieties to choose from. And things that you grow are more delicious than what you buy in the store.
They are. And, you know, I think it's kind of fortunate, but iceberg lettuce has been losing popularity for years. It's harder to grow. And it's just not very nutritious compared to other lettuce varieties. You know, the more nutritious lettuces are darker green and have red in the leaves.
Right, more antioxidants,
yes.
The darker, more color that you
and
have.
And I think they're more flavorful. I love romaine lettuce.
Me too. Mm-hmm.
And some of the other red lettuces much more than I do iceberg. You know, when I'm serving a salad, because I don't know people's preferences, I'll usually serve iceberg just to be safe. But I sure prefer these other varieties. And a lot of them, especially that are not the bunching lettuces or the head lettuces, are very easy to grow.
Right. And most of these can be grown here, right? We're talking about butterhead, romaine, other leafy lettuces.
Yes. And they can be grown just fine.
I'm looking at the fact sheet that you're putting up on the KSL Greenhouse Facebook page. What are some things, okay, other than not planting this rotating garden where you're making sure you have plenty, what are some other things people do wrong with lettuces?
You already mentioned not planting enough of it and the expectations on yields, especially if you're growing microgreens, you need a lot of it because you're harvesting those microgreens when they're about 3 to 4 inches tall. And so you need trays of this stuff. And then if you're doing this, especially indoors, it's a lot of work because once you've harvested those, all of the pots have to be dumped, washed, put new soil in, and reseeded. And so that's a lot of work. And you can imagine how much lettuce you're going to get on microgreens from a tray. And so you need a lot of it, unless you're just wanting to do it for hobby and get a salad once a month or so out of what you grew in your home. Mm-hmm. So that's going to be a challenge. And then learning to grow it because lettuce is only harvested once and then you transition and you have successive plantings. There are other greens that we discussed on the break that have different flavors
Swiss
that you can
favorite.
Get multiple harvests out of.
Mm-hmm.
So those Swiss chard, the mustard greens, I know those
that
can get.
That must be why I thought you could just cut them back and the lettuce would grow.
Yeah, and it will, but it's just not very spectacular.
Right.
But I've grown mustard greens, and if you harvest them when they're young, they don't get very bitter. And I like to mix, when I make a salad, maybe 10 to 15% mustard greens to the lettuce just to give it a little bit more flavor, you know, especially when you have a salad dressing, a vinegar based or even ranch. Those salad dressings are so strongly flavored that you drown the flavor of the salad out a little bit, and those mustard greens can give you a little bit of a pop.
One that I noticed in the article that we've posted on the Facebook page is Little Gem is one that I've not grown. But boy, I love the colors in this lettuce.
Yes.
It's
so
got
that's
a little bit of pinkish purple and green, and it's just beautiful.
Yeah. And there's others. Arugula is another one that is very easy to grow and can be quite expensive in stores. And I really like the flavor of arugula. And so there's so many things you can do with greens and lettuce.
And this is a good time to plant.
It really is. And if you want to grow them indoors, as our day lights start to increase, you know, in another month, you could grow your salad greens in a south window and they'd be perfectly happy.
All right. Check out the article on the KSL Greenhouse Facebook page. Gives you some ideas as well. Number to call with your questions, 801-575-8255. Phone lines are open, and you can text us at 57500. Thank you for spending your Saturday morning with the KSL Greenhouse. Maria and Ton with you, taking your calls and your questions. You can call us at 801-575-8255. Next listener, Ton, is gone back to something we were talking about arugula and whether you can plant it in Utah. And can you grow it successfully and how soon can it be planted?
We would plant it up in Cache Valley in mid-April as soon as we could work the soil.
Mm-hmm.
We grew it in the greenhouse in the winter, but we would grow it about the same time we did our mustard greens and the lettuce, and it did fine.
Next listener just wants to know, are seeded grapes more flavorful than the seedless grapes?
Not necessarily. The seeded grapes just have seeds, and that's the wild, more wild form. And so they're not as popular because we don't like to be sitting there with a spittoon spitting out grape seeds as you're eating them
or swallowing them. Mm-hmm.
So no, they're not necessarily more flavorful, but they are a lot of different flavors in seeded grapes that you will never be able to try if you only eat seedless varieties.
Hmm.
And so it's just that the flavor profiles are very diverse. And if you're willing to eat and use seeded grapes for different things, there's some wonderful ones out there. It's just that most people don't want them unless they're juicing them because of the hassle of dealing with the seeds.
You think they're better for juicing, though?
The seeded sometimes, grapes, right? Almost all grapes that we use for juice and wine have seeds
seeded,
in
right?
Yep.
Mm-hmm.
They don't remove the seeds.
Next person would like to know when they should prune shade trees.
Shade trees, anytime. I would get through the cold weather the next week or so, but late January is a great time to prune shade trees if you need to.
Where are the best places to grow asparagus?
Full sun. And USU has a great fact sheet on growing asparagus. You plant the little root starts and follow USU's instructions, but you actually don't start harvesting for about 3 years.
That's what I was wondering. It takes some time.
It does, but if you do it right, that patch will be productive for between 25 and 50 years.
Oh, so you need space.
You do. And you can keep them in a row by just using a spade so they don't go into your row middles. And then asparagus are actually quite drought hardy, and they prefer to be deep watered once they're established once weekly.
Next question is about lilacs. And after lilacs bloom in the spring, should they cut off the dry brown parts? And
yes.
When should that be done?
Anytime. As soon as they're done blooming, you can start cutting them.
This person says their paper whites have not bloomed. They're about two inches tall, not 2 feet. And they keep growing, but there are no blooms. They say they activated them the 1st of December. Any suggestions?
Be patient. Make sure that they're not being overwatered. Get them in a bright location.
They're kind of slow.
They are. And that's all you can do. And just let them do their thing.
I think they are so pretty. I just wish they smelled better.
Well, when you get unwanted company, just set them next to the unwanted company.
Oh, they don't smell that bad. You actually have to put your nose in them to smell them.
Yeah, I mean, they don't.
But they do surprise you because you're expecting this beautiful, sweet aroma, and it's not.
The reason they have that aroma is that they are pollinated by flies, and that is a similar aroma to what flies would be attracted to. And I know I'm not selling them very well. As an ornamental plant for your house, they're great. But just in the wild, the reason that scent is there is they're trying to attract certain pollinators.
Well, I'm glad to know that there at least is a reason for this beautiful plant having such a strange smell.
If you want to actually smell something stanky, hawthorns or pears, like the ornamental pears that everybody has, go give those a whiff when they're in full bloom.
They do not smell good.
Oh, they do not.
No, if you want something that smells wonderful and really puts out a great aroma, it's the Daphne.
Daphne is really good.
Oh my gosh, Daphne, you plant that on the side of your courtyard walking up to your house and people go, what is that? It's amazing.
Birkwood viburnum is another one that almost smells like a gardenia.
Mm-hmm.
In early spring, it blooms. In early to mid-April is another one. A pink dawn viburnum is another. So there's... In addition to the Daphnes, if you want those early spring scents, then in addition, a Birkwood viburnum and then the Pink Dawn are two others you could look at.
Okay. Next listener wants to know what the best vegetables are to grow where there isn't consistent sun. For example, a planter box on the side of their house.
If the area is getting at least 6 hours of sun, they should be able to grow most vegetables. So east exposure. But if they have planted tomatoes and they know that the soil is good and they've been watered correctly and the tomatoes struggle, it may be too shady. I've tried growing greens like lettuce in shaded areas in the summer. It's still too hot and they just struggle. And so that 6 hours is the minimum. But if you can get that, then most anything.
Next listener says they have a small backyard. They'd like to plant a peach tree that won't take up too much space. Is there a good dwarf variety to plant in vineyard?
Yes, there are several. They may need to order them online. But there's one called Bonfire that is a red leaf peach that is just gorgeous. It has dark red leaves all summer, and then you get an edible fruit on it, and it gets about 6x6. It looks like a little mini palm tree when it gets mature. Bonanza is another one that is just really cute. It's a green leafed one and the peaches taste pretty good.
Yeah, are the peaches good on
a
Bonfire?
I mean, they're not going to be in Alberta and O'Henry, but they're still very tasty. they're clingstone, but you're only going to get at the most on a mature tree a third of a bushel. So you've got enough to eat, but they taste wonderful, but they are, for smaller yards, they are so ornamental. Now, the consideration is that they're peaches, and so they'll get you peach tree borer, and you need to maintain them like a fruit tree, but they are so pretty.
So when we put in our yard some 30 years ago, we put in a dwarf apricot, and I can't tell you what variety of either of these, and a dwarf peach. My question is life shorter for the dwarf trees?
Not necessarily. They
because
need to
they
be
don't
staked.
Exist today.
They don't. They need to be staked. And even when you maintain a peach tree, either dwarf or semi-dwarf or whatever, 25 years is about the usable life if it's been well-maintained. Mm-hmm. Then it needs to come out and be replanted.
Person on the paper whites says they really are 2 feet tall.
Okay. Wow.
And still haven't bloomed.
Maybe for some reason they're on some sort of plant steroids. There is an article from Cornell about keeping paper whites small. Mm-hmm. And they actually are using alcohol, like vodka. And
what?
You mix it with water, so you dilute it down to like a 5%. Mm-hmm. But you can keep the paper whites down to 6 inches, and they still flower normally.
So are you saying that they could add vodka to these and maybe they'd bloom?
Look, you've got to get over, if you're not someone that consumes alcohol, you've got to get over the stigma of going into a state liquor store to get your vodka. But yeah, it works. There is an actual article out there.
If you have some sitting around the house, try that.
Yeah. Don't do Listerine. I don't think it's like 30% alcohol, but you can get vodka and some rums that are up to 70% alcohol, and you can get off-branded Everclear for the same. I've never consumed it, but I've used it for experimenting and other purposes. But I occasionally have gone into the liquor store because it is a lot cheaper to buy a really bad rum that's like 60 or 70% alcohol than it is to actually buy ethanol. And you can still dilute it. But yeah, there's an article from Cornell that you mix when you water, and you do this almost hydroponically, but if you mix so much ethanol alcohol into your water, it'll dwarf the paper whites, but they still bloom normally.
All
it has
right.
to be done when you put the bulbs in, though.
Number to call with your questions, 801-575-8255. Text us, 57500.
The Greenhouse Show on KSL News Radio.
Good morning. Thank you for spending your Saturday morning with the KSL Greenhouse. Maria Chaleos, Ton Bettis with you this morning. Number to call with your questions, and the phone lines are open for this last half hour of the show. Number to call, 801-575-8255. You can also text us at 57500. Next listener, Ton, is asking, how long is the life of clay-based soil that's been amended with topsoil a few times?
Well, topsoil into clay actually isn't doing you much good, unless it's like a commercial topsoil where they've already mixed a lot of compost into it.
Mm-hmm.
But if you went somewhere and bought their topsoil and mixed it into your clay, you actually haven't changed the characteristics of your soil very much.
Better thing to do
is or compost.
Why are people sometimes afraid of compost?
They just, it. There's just such a...
Do they
a,
think it's manure? Or
yeah,
do they...
I think it's more that there's this mystique about topsoil. It's just magical and it fixes everything, to where actual definition of topsoil is the top 6 inches to foot of soil, and it usually doesn't have any magical properties. It comes from construction sites that are being developed, and those construction sites may have sat for 2 or 3 years before the contractor got the permits to develop. And so you have a number of noxious weeds in it. And the vast majority of the time, bringing in topsoil isn't a solution to try to fix your own soil.
So mix a bunch of compost in there.
Yes. And so if you have clay soil, 3 inches of compost in the fall or early spring, mixed, tilled in, and then you do it again every year, 2 to 3 inches, until you have something that you're comfortable working with. Then 1 inch of compost in the fall mixed in will maintain what you've created.
Next listener says, is there a good strawberry or raspberry that will grow against the side of their house that faces directly west?
They may scorch just because of the hotter temperatures on the west side of the house. Mm-hmm. Raspberries, the darker purple ones are a little more resistant, so they could try that's a grape. Polka or Polana, those are very productive. And especially both of them will produce heavily in the fall when temperatures are cooler. So those might be some options. The strawberries usually ripen if you do a June bearer before really hot temperatures come, and they stop producing when it gets hot. And so they could do some productive June bearers to something like Honey Eye. There's others out there, but I would do a June bearing strawberry or a fall bearing raspberry.
Where is the best place to plant raspberries and
full sun?
Strawberries full sun.
Yeah,
matter,
both of
right?
them full sun, but a lot of commercial growers have actually started building shade structures over their whole patch because the berries will bear sooner. And they get very little sun scald because of the shade. We get enough sunlight, or in a more technical term, solar radiation, that you can put 30% shade over the tops of your tomatoes, peppers, raspberries, and it doesn't harm them. They still grow fine and they fruit sooner because of the cooler temperatures, and you don't get as nearly as much sun scald. And so when you go around Utah in areas where you have vegetable production and or few berry farms, most of them have put structures up to put 30% shade over the tops.
Yeah, I have seen a couple of yards in my neighborhood with shade, shade cloth.
Yes.
This past year. When is it really effective to use shade cloth?
When temperatures are above 90 is when it goes on.
Okay. So it can be effective, and because our temperatures have been getting hotter and hotter.
Yeah, starting in mid-June is when you put it on and you leave it until temperatures are regularly below 90, but it's okay to leave it on.
Okay. Doesn't cause any problems in the fall.
No, if you were in a different part of the country, say, the southeast, lower elevation, there it would be a problem, but because we're higher up and the atmosphere is a bit thinner, we have excessive solar radiation. And so to screen some of it out doesn't harm the plants.
The couple of yards that I did see this in, they actually, it was pretty extreme. Like they had put up like big 2x4s.
Yeah.
And I mean, they were pretty tall structures. How far away does that shade cloth have to be from the plant?
As long as the plants are shaded.
It doesn't matter, right?
It doesn't.
As long as it's not touching the plants.
Yeah. And you just want to keep it above the plant so that you can harvest. You can actually put shade over strawberries if you have summer bearers, and they will be more productive. Now, the cost, is you can buy a lot of strawberries for the cost. But if you want to do home production and increase your yields with the increasingly hotter temperatures, it is something we can do to increase our productivity.
So with strawberries, can it just lay on top of the strawberries?
No.
You still don't want it touching the plants.
No, but what I see people do is they will build a frame for a low tunnel that's sturdy so that they can put the plastic over it in the spring, and they make it so that the plastic is removable, or you just cut it out, and then you create a system to where you can put grommets or something in the shade cloth and just re-stretch it over the top of your cold frame and transition, say, from plastic to shade cloth, or like a floating row cover to shade cloth.
That actually makes a lot of sense to me.
Yeah.
And because it's already there. The structure's already there. You're using it for two purposes and you're extending your season.
Yes. I like those sorts of systems because if you can use what's called floating row cover, which is plastic, you can get different grades, and it's like a transition to where you have plastic and it's super hot underneath, but then the Remay, you can get it will increase temperatures anywhere from 1 to 10 degrees underneath and hold it at night a little bit, and then you can transition into shade. And so those cold frames or low tunnels that are sturdy, you can build for multi-purpose and put all sorts of coverings on them so you can use them throughout the season.
That makes a lot of sense to me. All right, number to call with your questions, 801-575-8255. You can also text us at 57500. Good morning. Thank you for joining us for the KSL Greenhouse. Maria and Ton with you, taking your calls at 801-575-8255. You can also text us at 57500. Ton, you've been doing a little bit of work with what? Wild parsnips? What's this about?
Yeah, parsnip isn't...
It's actually weeds, right?
It is. And we cultivate parsnips, which are not a super common crop, mm-hmm. but you grow them like carrots. And the cultivated parsnips are developed from the wild species. And so the parsnips that you grow in your garden are just fine to handle and things, but their wild cousins have some defenses against predation. And so,
which mean they're not good for you.
They're well, it's funny because the root is still edible, uh-huh. just fine. It may have a stronger flavor, but you can eat it. But the stems and the leaves and the seed heads are not really great. They're mean. They are.
Yes.
And so they're everywhere in the United States, except for maybe like Texas and areas like that.
So what do they look like? I mean, how would
they look
know?
Like a parsnip, except but they're bigger. They can get up to 6 feet tall.
Okay.
And they're usually biennial. So they'll form a rosette the first year, and that forms the taproot. Mm-hmm. And then they use the energy from the taproot the next year to make their seeds. But the defense that these wild parsnips have is they produce some chemicals that when you get the sap on your skin, the sap itself isn't harmful until it's exposed to sunlight or UV light.
Mm-hmm.
And then it produces secondary burns, blisters, and you will be blistered and have these rashes for at least 2 weeks after you're exposed. And then you will oftentimes get your skin discolored for up to 2 years after the fact. And if those areas are exposed to too much sunlight, they can burn really easily from sun because they're photosensitive. And so it's been sporadic, but we have seen exposures from all over the state, from wild parsnip in the summer. They grow in old pastures, along ditch banks and fallow areas. And they're fairly easy to identify. But I know one person that was pulling them from a lawn area, and it was the middle of the summer, and so she just had some shorts on. And
thinking it's harmless.
Yeah, and then the next day, blistered over a lot of her body.
Ugh.
And it took 2 weeks to get to a point that she could get up and get going. And a lot of times it will require some help from a dermatologist mm-hmm. for some creams and things, but if you are pulling weeds you're not familiar with, it's sometimes worth taking pictures and emailing them. But if you Google or do an internet search of wild parsnip, there are all sorts of fact sheets out there on what it looks like and how to handle it. But if you're digging it or pulling it, long sleeve shirt, gloves, and preferably something that isn't very water soluble on your gloves. And then you immediately wash the shirt, immediately take a shower with a good soap, wash down. And if you are exposed to the sap, immediately get that covered, get in the house and wash it. And it takes at least 8 hours for that sap to be broken down enough so that you can go out in the sun again.
I know a couple of years ago, I was out pulling weeds and had some blistering on my hand, and it had to be caused by something like that, if not that.
It may have very well been, because a lot of times poison ivy and poison oak aren't really present in our yards because we've just removed it.
Mm-hmm.
And it very well could have been a wild parsnip, because you don't know sometimes until the next day that you were exposed. And it's not an allergic reaction. It's an actual, and I'm not, I know there's a difference between a toxin and different things, but it is a toxin that gets on your skin that causes the burns.
You know, it's interesting. Last year, my brother from Pennsylvania was visiting, and he said, that weed you have in your yard, that is poisonous. And I went, are you sure? Like, I didn't even believe him. But there are things that we need to be aware of when we're out pulling weeds. I just don't pull them out without gloves.
Yeah. If you can sometimes do an internet search using a photo recognition, you know, in Google or another program.
Right.
And it's oftentimes they're pretty good. But, you know, out of caution, especially if it's new, you've never seen it, mm-hmm. maybe put on a pair of gloves, wash up when you're done. Because there's a lot of things in our yards that are poisonous. It's just that we wash after we're done and we don't eat it.
Right. Next, listeners would like you to talk about the best structure to support grapes, weatherproof and sturdy, but not too ugly. as well as maybe a magpie deterrent. What are the best structures?
There, if you build a proper trellis, it is very easy to net the grapes to keep the birds out. And so Michael Caron would be a little bit better for this. He's our state grape specialist. But if you get online and just look up grape trellises, almost all of them will have cross arms. And so you have a post going up 6 or 8 feet in the air, and then you have a cross arm that reaches out a couple feet in either direction. And then in between them, you will have supports, but you put these cross arms at the end of each row and sporadically through your row, depending on the length. And if you have those cross arms, you can order bird netting online and just net your grapes. And it's very easy to do, but this is also meaning that you're pruning your grapes in the spring properly so that you can keep them contained to do it. The other trick to it is sometime in late July to mid-August, you go through with some hedge trimmers because your vines will grow to the ground, and about 3 feet off the ground, you hedge trim all the vines so that you can secure the netting underneath the grapes.
Mm-hmm. How do you keep your grapes from forming a huge ancient clump?
Pruning. It's okay for the stump to get really big, but off of that main trunk, you have side branches, which are called, they grow from what are called cordons. And what you're doing is generating new vines that are never more than 2 years old. And so the grape producing vines are from last year, and those will come off the next season. And the vines that you leave behind are only 1 year old. And so there is never a vine on your grape besides maybe the trunk and maybe 6 inches out that's older than 1 year,
maintenance.
2 years.
There's the answer to the question.
Maintenance.
Right.
And to get the sweetest, biggest grapes, that is the kind of pruning you do. Otherwise, your grapes start to get small and a little less flavorful than if you do prune them.
Okay, we have just a minute left. I know a call is coming in on Venus flytrap varieties. But we're not going to have enough time to answer that question.
I will say very quickly, if they can find Venus flytrap, buy it, because you're not going to find a lot of varieties out there from local garden centers.
Okay, so they'd maybe have to call around. Where would you suggest somebody look?
Someplace that carries a lot of houseplants, J&J Nursery in Davis County, Cooks in Utah County are two that I know of, Western Gardens in the Salt Lake area.
Okay, but you're
Cactus
not going to be able to be too choosy about the variety.
No, you're not.
All right. I'm sorry we didn't have more time to answer your call, Alvin. Thanks for calling in this morning. If you're just joining us this morning, the plant of the week was spider plant. We talked about quantities of seeds to grow. You can find a lot of great information, including an article on planting greens in your yard on the KSL Greenhouse Facebook page. Have a great weekend. We'll be back next week, 8 to 11, and we always love answering your questions. So thanks so much for listening this morning.